always on the go, but the day just won't be one without your Hollywood fix. Let Golden State Media Concepts Entertainment Podcast take care of that. An all-inclusive look of pop culture.
Greetings, good people of the planet Earth and the known universe. You're listening to Golden State Media Concepts Entertainment Podcast. This is your Captain Keith, and I've got a lot of entertainment for you today. Yes, I do. So, and our podcast episode description is, you know, the full description, because I couldn't type it all out. It's really keeping up with Kanye, you know, Drake and slavery interview. Mel B rehab and Stephen Colbert anxiety. So those are the headlining stories, but there's so much more. And let's get to it. How Mel B's America's Got Talent co-stars are supporting her ahead of rehab. Following the revelation that Mel B is planning on entering rehab after the conclusion of this season of America's Got Talent, the performer's AGT family is doing everything they can to support their friend and co-star. Tuesday's new live episode was the first to air since the news broke. Though the former Spice Girls star made no reference to her announcement during the broadcast, however, after the show, Mel B's fellow judges opened up to ET about her struggles. Okay. She's a very strong, wonderful lady who's battled what a lot of people battle. Fellow judge Howie Mandel stated to Danny Directo after Tuesday's show, "I'm just amazed at how she can show up and be a true professional and just a wonderful person who is entertaining. And I'm thrilled and I feel lucky that I get to sit beside her and that America gets to enjoy her and watch her and listen to her," Mandel added. While it was originally reported by a number of tabloids that Mel B was seeking treatment for alcohol and sex addiction, the singer shot down those rumors during an interview with the Ellen DeGeneres show and explained that she's looking to get help dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder associated with her father's death last year and her subsequent divorce from Stephen Belafonte. Mandel said that he is ready and willing to help Mel B with whatever she needs from me. I hope that she would reach out and I'll reach out to her, he shared. She's a friend, and I think we have to be there for our friends and people we admire. And she's certainly someone I admire, and whatever she wants from me and needs from me, I'm there for her. Okay, that's cool. I can dig that. Heidi Klum, or Klum, shared similar sentiments, stating, "I'm her friend, and I've been her friend for a really long time, and I'm always going to be there for her and help her with whatever she needs help in." As for Simon Cowell, who has famously had something of a contentious relationship with Mel B, the outspoken English TV personality said he has a lot of respect for her work ethic and professionalism. Mel's a trooper. She comes to the show, leaves everything behind, focuses on the contestant. That is a true professional, Cowell said. She's so professional. It's all about the contestants with her. So a lot of respect for her. While Mel B didn't do press interviews after the show, she opened up to Ellen's guest host, Lea Michele, and explained the reason for her upcoming rehab stint. "I've been in therapy since my father got diagnosed with cancer 9 years ago. My therapy changed a little bit because I was in a very intense relationship, which you can all read about in my book, Brutally Honest," Mel B shared. "I do address a lot of those issues, but you know, I'm not an alcoholic. No, I'm not a sex addict." Okay, very happy that Mel B is going to get the treatment that she needs. And I do believe that, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, definitely, especially if, you know, if there's been abuse in a relationship, yeah, I get that. But it's just funny. I mean, you have to be careful because if you keep on saying, "I'm not an alcoholic and I'm not a sex addict," it's kind of like, you know, me think you doth protest too much. But, you know, it's very possible that, you know, with the tabloids, that's just, you know, that sounds more exciting and sexy than she has, PTSD. So I get it. I mean, it sounds, you know, it sounds more ooh, you know, racy and, you know, just titillating. Oh, yeah, she's alcoholic and she's a sex addict. You know, that sells papers. Not a Spice Girl has PTSD. So I get it. So, you know, we definitely wish her well here. Definitely. So but it's just kind of messed up that you have to tell people that because they're automatically thinking the wrong thing about you and they don't even know you. So I get it. Yeah, I just answered my own question. Okay, there we go. Anna Faris and Chris Pratt hang out for a day, out for a second day in a row. So the recently divorced couple, here we go. Anna Faris and Chris Pratt are proving once again that they're amicable exes. The former pair who split last August after 8 years of marriage hung out for the second day in a row on Tuesday, taking a morning stroll in Santa Monica, California. Both dressed casual for the outing, with Faris in a simple white t-shirt, skinny jeans, and a black and gray baseball cap, and Pratt in a matching hat, button-down shirt, shorts, and sneakers. Faris, 41, and Pratt, 39, were also spotted together on Monday, taking a walk and holding hands with their six-year-old son, Jack. And while they seem to be experts at co-parenting, the two have both moved on with different partners. Pratt is currently dating Katherine Schwarzenegger, 39, same age as him, while Faris has reportedly been seeing her overboard cinematographer, Michael Barrett, who's 48. Okay. A source states in July that Pratt's relationship with Schwarzenegger has become serious quickly after paparazzi captured shots of them kissing in public while out with the actor's son. They went from casually dating to spending much more time together, the source said at the time. Chris and Catherine have introduced one another to their family and friends and have been almost inseparable when they are free. Until he knew it was more than just casual, he wasn't introducing Jack to anyone, the source added. Chris and Catherine are very happy together. Okay. Alrighty. Lethal Weapon star Clayne Crawford breaks silence on shocking firing, claims he was blackmailed. So now before I get into this story, I didn't even know that until I was doing my research that he got fired. Now, Lethal Weapon, the TV series, happens to be a rarity. It's a hit on television, I believe on Fox. So usually when you take a movie, a hit movie, and you make a TV series from it, it fails. There's only been, off the top of my head, two shows that that was not the case. The first one being MASH. And the second one being Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But most of the time when you try to take a movie and make it into a TV series, it doesn't go well. So the reason why I'm mentioning this is the simple fact that Clayne Crawford played the character that Mel Gibson played in the movie. So if you're firing him, and mind you, you look at this show, you know it's Damon Wayans' show. Damon Wayans is the more popular, the more well-known actor. He's more successful. So this was basically like a breakout role for Clayne Crawford, to my knowledge. So when you look at this show, you know, okay, this is Damon's show, which is fine. But I guess my only concern is that if you fire the other half of the legendary Lethal Weapon team, how are you going to continue the show? Because now you're going to have really good writing, to pull that off if you're going to do this movie as a series without one of the main characters from the movie. He's one half of the, he's the second half, you know, of an important duo. It's just, yeah, that's like doing Lethal Weapon today with Danny Glover and there's no Mel Gibson. It don't add up. It's not going to work. But hey, prove me wrong. Let's see what you do. So are you guys going to use the same character but give him a different face like Aunt Viv on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air? Because that really, yeah, I didn't care for that. So I watched it. Well, and then I stopped watching, actually. And I think Daphne Reed's an amazing actress and her husband Tim Reed, I like them both. So, and she did a good job. It just wasn't the same for me. So when you do recasting, you got to be real careful. So we'll see what happens with that. Let me read the story, but I had to just say that. I had to, yeah, let you guys know. Wait a minute. This is kind of strange. So let's get into the story. Lethal Weapon star Clayne Crawford was fired in May after it was revealed that he was reprimanded twice for his on-set behavior. And in a candid new interview, the actor bluntly tells his side of the story. Okay. Well, if you've been warned twice and you're, okay. All right, here we go. Crawford appeared on the podcast Drinking Bros, his first interview since his premature exit from the Fox show, and claims he was never even informed with a phone call that he had been officially fired, but rather learned of his firing through social media. Ouch. Crawford, who played troubled cop Martin Riggs on Lethal Weapon, that was also Mel Gibson back in the movie, was one of the two main stars on the series alongside Damon Wayans, exactly, who played his straight-laced partner Roger Murtaugh, Danny Glover's character. It's a little different when you replace Becky or the mom off of Fresh Prince. Like, if they replaced the Fresh Prince, we'd have been like, what the heck are we watching anyway? That's why I just didn't think it was possible, Crawford comments. I just didn't think they were going to get rid of me, I guess. And if they did, I thought they'd give me a buzz, just a jangle. Just grab two cans and a string and just be like, you're not coming back. We feel like this is the Damon Wayans show and people just don't like you. So go the F back to Alabama, you dumb hick. Thanks for playing. Ooh, I mean, that was his quote from the podcast. As for the leaked tapes Variety published that capture 40-year-old Crawford yelling profanities during an onset outburst, the actor claims he was previously blackmailed with the release of the tapes when he would complain about Wayne's own behavior. Variety reported at the time that Crawford became particularly frustrated while shooting at a public pool in Los Angeles, partly due to children at the pool, which was supposed to be closed to the public, creating background noise. I snapped, Crawford recalls of the incident, though insists that it's a blatant, you know, freaking lie that he ever yelled at children. Should I have gone to my trailer? 100%. Should I have just gone and waited? That's what I was instructed to do when there was a problem. You go sit in your trailer and you lock your door and you take a nap. Hollywood is very sensitive, so I should not have screamed and yelled, right? Because there's a bunch of very delicate flowers out there. Okay. I knew that they were going to release these tapes because they've been blackmailing me with them for months and months and months. The entire second season, Crawford alleges, also claiming that Wayans was behind the negative stories about him prior to his firing. And I have all the text messages from these people and voicemails from these people saying, obviously you're not the problem, but you've got to get ahead of this because, you know, they're going to use those tapes against you. Crawford says he was also encouraged to publicly apologize to Wayans by Warner Brothers studio president Peter Roth in order to save his job. I can't apologize to this guy, Crawford says of his mentality at the time towards 57-year-old Wayans. He has made life miserable for me on the show, and I also feel like they're already moving forward. I feel like if I apologize, they're going to use that to justify this poor decision they're making in supporting his bad behavior and his ego. Warner Brothers has not sent out a statement regarding Crawford's allegations. Clearly, there's no love lost. Excuse me. I'm going to slow back, rewind, and take my time. Clearly, there's no love lost between Wayans and Crawford. In May, Wayans alleged Crawford caused his bloody onset injury and relished in making females cry. After some fans slammed Wayans following the news that Crawford has been replaced by actor Sean William Scott, he also alleged that Crawford hit another actor in the mouth with a bottle. He became uninsurable. Okay, never used that word before, but all right. Wayans tweeted in part before deleting his tweets, relished in making females cry and stuck fear in cast and crew. Hashtag don't blame me. So yeah, so it looks like it's a case of he said, she said, and looks like, yeah, there was a mutual dislike on both sides. Last week, Lethal Weapon debuted its first promo for season 3, giving fans the first look at Scott in the series. Scott will play Wesley Cole, the new partner to Wayans Murtaugh. Okay. I might have to check it out. I do like Sean William Scott, so it'll be interesting. Lethal Weapon returns Tuesday, September 25th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Pacific Standard Time on Fox. And there it is. Jason Bateman and Laura Linney are making the unsettling authentic in Ozark Season 2, the hit Netflix series that is crazy and so much fun to watch, even from the first episode, from the first opening scene. That's all I'm going to say about that. Ozark is Jason Bateman like you've never seen him before. The 49-year-old actor has become known and beloved to fans for his portrayals of the modest family man trying to prove himself and do the right thing. In Ozark, he still plays a family man, but as viewers quickly learned in season 1, Marty Bird isn't exactly a modest guy, and his moral compass is questionable. It's questionable at best. The Netflix series follows Bateman's character, a financial planner caught between the FBI, the Mexican cartel, and local criminals in the Ozarks. Marty's willing to do whatever it takes to get himself and his family above water, and that only escalates in season two. So I can't wait to see that, because season one was amazing. More about this after this break.
Want to find out what movies to go see? Then check out the GSMC Movie Podcast. It's your ticket to the latest movies, whether it's a new blockbuster event, romantic, comedy, or action flick. This show has got it all covered. They talk some what to go see now. Don't bother. What's hot on Netflix and everything in between? That's GSMCpodcast.com/movie-podcast. When it's all about the movies, it has to be this new show. Don't forget to like them on Facebook and follow them on Twitter. Visit GSMCpodcast.com for more info.
Back once again, you're listening to Golden State Media Concepts Entertainment Podcast. This is your Captain Keith talking about the hit series Ozark on Netflix and season two coming soon. So things go up stakes wise in many areas. We make no concern for that, Bateman recently stated to ET's Leanne Aguilera at Netflix Summer Television Critics Association Press Day. We got to give them a good blood splatter here and there, or a good shock there and there. What we try to do is just make sure when stuff does happen, whether it's an emotional explosion or a physical problem, that it feels authentic and it's unsettling. He explained, adding that a car crash in the show might happen slightly off frame, just as someone would witness it out of the corner of their eye in real life. Sometimes that adds to how chilling some of the stuff is. Bateman, who executive produces and sometimes directs Ozark, he's nominated for Emmys for both acting and directing the series, actually, excellent, said that the sophomore season learns that leans into the show's off-kilter nature even more. I think we're 1 year better at doing that, he teased. I hope. Laura Linney, who plays Marty's wife, Wendy, also becomes a larger part of the family's criminal escapades in season two, taking initiative and control on her own. Still, some of her favorite scenes are with her on-screen husband. I love coming to set and seeing, like, how is he going to handle this monologue? How is he going to do this? How is this going to fly out of his mouth? And it's a really unique skill, she said of Bateman's acting. She's also a big fan of him in the director's chair. Our company is happiest when he is directing. The set runs the best. We're all comfortable. There is a sense of trust that we're taken care of. And as an actor, it's the same thing. It's the same guy, which is nice. It's not a schizophrenic relationship, she said. It's not like, you know, when he's acting, he behaves one way. And when he's a director, he's a total jerk. That's good to know. I like that. That's a very nice comment from your co-star. He never changes in a good way. He's very consistent, co-star Julia Garner added. The 24-year-old actress captivates as local criminal turned Marty's apprentice, Ruth Langmore. She is great on the show. I really do like her. She's a trip. A girl torn between her family's desire to swindle Marty and her hopes to actually learn from him. Because Ruth's father is out of jail in season two, you definitely see a much more vulnerable side of Ruth, Garner promised. Everybody's trying to find their identity on the show, but this season she's really trying to find her identity because she's conflicted between Marty and her father. There's a lot of things that are not clear for her. Things also get shaken up by a new addition to the cast. Janet McTeer joins as a cartel lawyer who comes to town to investigate the disappearance of their crime lord, Camino del Rio, Asai Morales. Oh yeah, I forgot about that scene. She's just got a great presence, Bateman marveled, as Lane joked, that McTeer's height alone at over 6 feet makes her feel safe and secure, even if that's not her character's objective. She would at least be able to see where you could get out of the room because her head is higher than everybody else's, Bateman cracked. Oh, they're funny. The co-stars definitely don't have a hard time joking around amid the show's serious, dark, and somewhat graphic, as they noted, nature. But Bateman recommends that those tuning into the show's second season don't breeze through it like a comedy. Oh, yeah, there's nothing funny about the show. Not really. I mean, the episodes are an hour in each, and you want to be able to absorb what you saw and try to guess where are they going to go from here. And then maybe talk about it with somebody. Bateman advised, adding he likes to watch the show two episodes at a time, but it's ultimately up to the viewer. That's the great thing about Netflix. You can race your own race. I agree. Season 2 of Ozark premieres Friday on Netflix. Yes, and I will be there. Janet Jackson recreates Remember the Time music video for Michael Jackson's 60th birthday. Wow, the King of Pop would have been 60 today. That's crazy. Today would have been Michael Jackson's 60th birthday, and his sister Janet Jackson is honoring the late icon in a truly touching way. Janet posted a clip in which she is dressed as an African queen, sending unentertaining performers to their death. Sound familiar? That's because it's precisely the setup of her brother's acclaimed music video for his 1992 track, Remember the Time. In the remake, performer who catches Janet's eye is Titi, the alter ego of a viral video star, Quaylen Rogers, better known as at Blame It on Quay. Rocking an elaborate hat, a light green wig, a black tube top, and a green skirt, the social media star breaks into a dance with two women by his side. Devotees will remember it was the Somali-American model Iman who was the terrifying queen in the original music video, and it was obviously Michael who charmed her with his singing and dancing. Eddie Murphy and Magic Johnson also appeared in Michael's video. Janet is hardly the only celebrity paying tribute to Michael on the special day. Chance the Rapper, Smokey Robinson, and Akon also share posts honoring the King of Pop, and Michael's own nephew, TJ Jackson, posted a touching message. You inspired me, you taught me, you changed me, TJ wrote. You kept me going in my darkest hour, and I will always be grateful for you. You were magical, yet so humble. You taught me the power of dreaming. You showed me what a real man is. I love you so much and miss you every single day. Michael died on June 25th, 2009. It's 9 years ago. That was 9 years ago. Of cardiac arrest brought on by propofol, and benzodiazepines, which are used to treat anxiety and insomnia. His physician, Dr. Conrad Murray, was later convicted of involuntary manslaughter for administering the drugs. Take a breath on that one. Taylor Swift pays tribute to Aretha Franklin with a moment of silence during the Detroit show. Taylor Swift is paying tribute to Aretha. The pop star performed a Reputation tour show in the Queen of Soul's hometown of Detroit, Michigan, on Tuesday, where she honored the legendary singer who died earlier this month at the age of 76 from pancreatic cancer. Detroit, last week we lost an irreplaceable force, Aretha Franklin, Swift said to the sold-out crowd at the Ford Field. She did so much for music. She did so much for women's rights. She did so much for civil rights. She was one of those people where no matter what you say, no matter what glowing positive things you said about her, it would be an understatement. Words could never, ever describe how many things she did in her lifetime that made our world a better place. She continued, and this is her home. Swift's speech came about 45 minutes into her set and was followed up with a moment of silence for Franklin. A concert girl states that Swift asked her crew to turn the house lights down for the tribute, and that aside from a few shout-outs to Swift, it was quiet for a solid minute. Earlier in the day, fans of Franklin's flocked to Detroit's Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History to pay their final respects to the late singer. Once doors closed, members of the Delta Sigma Theta sorority hosted a memorial service of their own as a way to commemorate Franklin, who was initiated as an honorary member in June 1992. The Detroit News reports, I did not know she was a DST. Okay. Day 2 of public viewings are happening Wednesday, that's today, with a funeral for friends and family at Greater Grace Temple on Friday. It's also confirmed on Tuesday that Ariana Grande will be performing at the Queen of Soul's Celebration of Life with additional performances by stars like Stevie Wonder, Faith Hill, Jennifer Hudson, Fantasia, Jennifer Holliday, and Franklin's son Edward. Franklin's family asked Grande, 24, to be part of the funeral service after they were moved by her performance of You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman on The Tonight Show, starring Jimmy Fallon. According to Associated Press, oh, I didn't know she did that. Ariana can sing. She can sing, so yeah, I have to give her that. So now I have to look that up so I can see it. I had no idea. So, and I have another story about Aretha, which I might give you now or later on the podcast. You'll get that later on the podcast. Save the best for last, because the queen is the best. So she deserves that respect, pun intended and included. Stephen Colbert shares his struggle with anxiety and why he stopped taking Xanax. All right. So let's dig into this. Stephen Colbert is opening up about how he's been able to deal with anxiety. In a new interview, actually with Rolling Stone, the 54-year-old late show host recalls how he needed to be medicated when he was younger and that he had a nervous breakdown after he got married to his wife, Evelyn, in 1993. What's that about? I was actually medicated, he says. I mean, in the most common prosaic way. Xanax was just lovely, you know, for a while. And then I realized that the gears were still smoking. I just couldn't hear them anymore, but I could feel them. I could feel the gearbox heating up and smoke pouring out of me, but I was no longer walking around a couch. I had a bit of nervous breakdown after I got married, kind of panic attacks, he continues. My wife would go off to work and she'd come home because I worked at night, and I'd be walking around the couch and she's like, "How was your day?" And I'd say, "You're looking at it, just tight circles around the couch." Colbert says he was able to deal with his severe anxiety by performing. Okay. I would go to the show. I would curl up in a ball on the couch backstage and I would wait to hear my cue lines. He remembers. Then I would uncurl and go on stage and I'd feel fine, which occurred to me at the time. Like, oh, you feel fine when you're out here. And then as soon as I got off stage, I just come onto a ball again. Nobody ever asked me what was wrong. It went on for months. So that's really interesting. Sorry to hear that. The comedian explains his decision to quickly stop taking Xanax, a medication commonly prescribed to treat anxiety disorders. I stopped the Xanax after like 9 days, he reveals. I went, "This isn't helping," so I just suffered through it. I sometimes hold the bottle to go like, "I could stop this feeling if I want it, but I'm not going to. Because I know if I stop the feeling, somehow I'm not working through it. Like I have got to go through the tunnel with spiders in it." And then one morning I woke up and my skin wasn't on fire, and it took me a while to figure out what it was. I wake up the next morning, I'm perfectly fine, to the point where my body's still humming. I'm a bell that's been rung so hard that I can still feel myself vibrating. But the actual sound was gone because I was starting rehearsal that day to create a new show. And then I went, "Oh my God, I can never stop performing." Creating something is what helped me from just spinning apart like an unweighted flywheel, he notes. And I haven't stopped since. Even when I was a writer, I always had to be in front of a camera a little bit. I had to perform. Nothing's wrong with that, man. I like the camera too. During the Canon interview, Colbert also came to the defense of fellow late night host Jimmy Fallon, who faced criticism after interviewing Donald Trump in September 2016 before he became president. Fallon was accused of being too playful with Trump, at one point running his hand through his hair and not asking him any difficult questions. "I think that's a completely unfair critique of Jimmy Fallon's show," Colbert comments. "You do not go to Jimmy Fallon's show for political satire or even political discussion. He's an entertainer and he's brilliant. People blame his ratings on that. But I think people just have a different appetite right now for political comedy. I think it's highly overblown, that hair ruffling thing." Earlier this month, rapper Nicki Minaj left Colbert speechless during her appearance on the CBS The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, thanks to her impromptu flirty rap about him. I saw that portion of that episode, and it was cute. And she was really good. It was really funny. Yeah, they had really good. They had Nicki and Stephen have very good chemistry together. Yes. Yeah, it was real cool. Kirk Douglas is 101 years old, people. Gazes at 8-month-old great-granddaughter Lua in a touching photo. So I didn't even know this until today. I mean, I knew he was like getting up there or up there. I didn't know he was 101. He may be the oldest Hollywood actor, surviving a Hollywood actor right now. He's 101 years old. I'm sorry. I'm just like in shock. So, I mean, that's amazing. He's still here, you know. Four generations, Kirk Douglas spent some quality time with his great-granddaughter, Lua, Aloha, if I'm saying it right, this week, and the multi-generational photo is all kinds of cute. Cameron Douglas, the son of Michael Douglas and DeAndre Luker, proudly shared the image of his grandfather getting to know his 8-month-old daughter, Lua, who he shares with yoga instructor Vivian Thibes, or Thibes. I don't know if I'm saying her name right or not. Thibes. In a touching black and white pic, Lua is seen reaching for Kirk, who is sitting on a chair looking down at her. Cameron simply captioned the heartwarming image, love. And more about this story after this break.
Tired of searching the vast jungle of podcasts? Now listen close and hear this out. There's a podcast network that covers just about everything that you've been searching.
Hey!
The Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network is here. Nothing less than a podcast bliss with endless hours of podcast coverage. From news, sports, music, fashion, cooking, entertainment, fantasy, football, and so much more. So stop lurking around and go straight out to the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. Guaranteed to fill that podcast itch. Whatever it may be. Visit us at www.gsmcpodcast.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And download us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play.
Once again, you're listening to Golden State Media Concepts Entertainment Podcast with Captain Keith speaking. And we were talking about Kirk Douglas and his great-granddaughter and how he's 101 years old. Lua has a special connection with her great-grandfather as her middle name, Izzy, is in honor of the 101-year-old actor's birth name, Isser Danielovich. Since she was born last December, the little one has been meeting lots of her famous family. When she was just a month old, Cameron snapped a photo of him posing with his daughter, who was being held by Kirk. Words cannot express. Hashtag powerful. Hashtag bloodline. He wrote. That same month, she also spent time with her step-grandmother, Catherine Zeta-Jones, as well as her grandfather, Michael. Zizi and Lua, watch out for this duo! Exclamation mark. Cameron captioned the pic of Catherine and Lua along with the hashtags hashtag thoroughly blessed, hashtag loved and spoiled, hashtag loved and hashtag spoiled. Another pic of the Douglas family, he wrote, what it's all about, a star and a hashtag blessed with hashtag family. A lot of hashtagging going on, man. Okay. Very cool, though. Nicki Minaj gushes over Ariana Grande's fiance, Pete Davidson. Does he have a brother? Yeah, I can't even make it up, man. I can't even make it up. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It is a nice picture of Nicki and Ariana. It is a cute picture of them. Okay. Nicki Minaj is looking for a man just like Pete Davidson. The 35-year-old rapper took to the comment section of Ariana Grande's latest post, where the pop star showed off her husband-to-be in the black and white pic. Davidson, 24, has a giant grin on his face while rocking a backwards baseball hat and a striped shirt. The second shot in the slideshow is of a woman looking at her phone and adjusting her sunglasses, seemingly appreciating what she's seeing on the screen. And then, quote, OMG at the most perfect man on the planet. WTF, does he have a brother? BTCH, ? Exclamation mark. Minaj comment on the post. Though Minaj may be out of luck with her hopes of meeting Davidson's non-existent brother, the Saturday Night Live star only has one sibling, Sister Casey. Someone else made their availability known to her. Yeah, me, Machine Gun Kelly wrote in response to Minaj's comment. Davidson just recently starred in the rapper's music video for a song, Loco. It's no surprise that Minaj and Grande may have the same taste in men. The duo have been close for years, from collaborating on songs to hanging out at the MTV Video Music Awards. Grande even shaded Travis Scott, whose album Astroworld beat Minaj's Queen for the number one spot earlier this month. It's funny. Yeah, that whole thing with Travis Scott outselling Nicki, everyone's doing too much. You know, it's sales. It's record sales. It happens. You just can't, you know, yeah, that whole thing was just kind of, I don't see that at all. You can't be mad because someone sold more records than you, no matter what they did to promote it. You know, no one's forcing people to buy more records. It is what it is. So, Stephen Amell earned less than his co-stars as Arrow's leading man from the hit TV series Arrow on CW, for, you know, which is short for Green Arrow. Stephen Amell tells it like it is. The 37-year-old actor was a guest on Michael Rosenbaum's Inside of You podcast Tuesday, where he spoke candidly about what it's like to be the lead of the CW smash Arrow. Amell was cast as Oliver Queen / Green Arrow, a billionaire playboy turned Matt's vigilante in 2011. It's been 7 years. Arrow was Amell's first leading role, and at the time, I didn't really care what the deal was, he said. It was a fair deal. I had no quote. I had never been a series regular before. I was a series regular on Hung, technically, but I wasn't going to be bumped up to a series regular price until the fourth season, right? If there was a fourth season, which there wasn't. And by the way, Hung starred Thomas Jane on HBO, where he was this... I think he might have been a gym teacher, but he was a school teacher. And because apparently he was well endowed, he wound up becoming a undercover part-time gigolo. He's also a divorcee. That was the HBO show, and I don't know why they canceled it. I loved that show. That show was amazing. So I forgot that Stephen Amell was on that show. Yeah, that show was amazing. It was funny. So funny. And he had a pimp, and she was a very quirky lady. Yeah, the show was amazing. But I digress. Let's get back to Stephen Amell and Arrow. But look up Hung on like Netflix, or look up Hung. Just look for it. It's good. It's a really good show. Yeah, they jumped the shark on that one. They should have kept that one going. It was a very, very fair deal. It was a very, very fair deal. I mean, the first thing they did was to try to hire me as a Canadian. That was a big no-no, as it meant he would be earning less money and wouldn't be eligible to receive residuals. That's the first conversation. Oh, okay. That they have, and my agent shut it down immediately. Basically, the business affairs person comes back semi-embarrassed and says, you know, I got to ask. Even after the contract was signed, Amell had to push back behind the scenes. Not wanting to be taken advantage of, despite his inexperience as a leading man, Amell recalled when he had to defend himself while reshooting a scene for an episode in season one. In the early days, we didn't do a lot of reshoots, but they were not happy with a couple elements of episode five, he said. So Amell was called in to rework some scenes with co-star Katie Cassidy. And that's when he reached his breaking point and once again asserted himself. We had been working six days a week for a couple of weeks, coming in Sundays and doing that. I'm in the Arrow costume. I've got the effing eye makeup on, and it was 11:15 at night or whatever. The second assistant director said to me, your call time tomorrow is 11:15. And I said, I'm not done for the day. I can't. Base camp is 20 minutes away, and I've got to take my makeup off. It's not my turnaround. I'm exhausted. I'm going to take my turnaround. And he said, contractually, your call time is 11:15, and I don't have to give you any explanation. The actor remembered. I said, okay, I'm going to tell you this right now. I'm going to do it in front of people so that everybody knows this. I'm going to get in the car tomorrow at the exact time that I get in the car tonight, and not a minute sooner. And if you had handled this with a little more tact, maybe we could have done something, but you didn't. So when everybody asks why we are starting later than everyone wants to, you need to tell them it's your fault. You do get pushed around, he added, but I recognize my value, I think, pretty early on. By the time Amell's first contract renegotiations rolled around, he admitted it became weird and a little personal, as he told Rosenbaum, who had similar experiences making the CW Smallville. Yes, folks, let me say something about that real quick. Michael Rosenbaum was Lex Luthor on Smallville. When it comes to Superman history and fanfare and lore and legend of that amazing, iconic franchise and their characters and the people who have played Superman, you know, you remember George Reeves or Reeve, Superman from the black and white TV series. And then in the 70s and 80s, you remember Christopher Reeves, who was an amazing Superman, and Clark Kent. May he rest in peace. You also had Dean Cain, and you had Brandon Routh, and of course, Tom Welling. So here's what I'm saying. People talk about who plays Superman, but they don't talk about who plays Lex Luthor. So the Lex Luthor everyone remembers is basically Gene Hackman from the Superman movies with Christopher Reeve. And yeah, sometimes it was okay. I mean, Gene Hackman is a great actor. I never cared for the humor, jokey-joke version of Lex Luthor. Lex Luthor was always a very serious villain, an evil genius. So when Smallville came along on CW, and Tom Welling got casted as Clark Kent, the man who would be Superman, and then Michael Rosenbaum got casted as Alexander Luthor, a.k.a. Lex Luthor, Michael Rosenbaum is like the greatest Lex Luthor ever. That's just my opinion. He was amazing. He was a very important part of that TV show. So if you want to know what Lex Luthor really is, you know, as far as that iconic villain, that character, Superman's arch nemesis, Michael Rosenbaum did it, and he did it 5,000% well. The only other Lex I like right now is Jesse Eisenberg from the Batman vs. Superman movie. And yes, I liked the movie, saw it 3 times, and I own the Ultimate Edition. Yes, yes, yes. Jesse Eisenberg is the only other Lex. He's not as good as Michael Rosenbaum, but he's a close second. Because Lex Luthor was a genius, and you never got that from Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman did a great job, especially his chemistry with Ned Beatty, but I never felt like Gene Hackman was this evil mastermind. I always felt like he was just this guy who wanted attention from Superman. But when you look at Michael Rosenbaum and his friendship with Clark Kent before he became Superman, it's just tension. I mean, it's just a tense. It's just, it simmers the chemistry and the intensity and the truths and the lies and how they fluctuate back and forth. And, you know, there were times when I was watching Smallville where I was rooting for Lex because I could see Clark lying to him unnecessarily. And there are other times where I was rooting for Clark because Lex was in the wrong. And that's what made that show great. So Michael Rosenbaum was amazing as Lex Luthor. Amazing. He's my favorite Lex. So, let me get back to the story. But I had to share that with you. So, you know, he's got a podcast. I'm going to check out his podcast, and I'm doing a podcast. But yeah, he was great. So it's cool to see him talking to Stephen Amell and possibly giving him advice about what it's like to be in the CW DC universe. So I think that's cool. The only issue I had in the first couple of years was I think that up until the end of the second season, I was the 4th or 5th highest paid cast member because I had no quote. I think this is coming from Michael Rosenbaum, actually. They gave me what they termed as a gift after season 2. It's them raising my salary without asking for anything in return. My thing was very simple. I just said, quite frankly, I work way more than everybody else, especially in season 1 and season 2. It was way more disproportionate than it is now. I think somebody was making X. They're like, okay, your new salary is going to be X minus like $1,250 per episode. And I go, what are you doing? That's not the most amount of money. They said, yeah, no, it's the most amount of money over the course of 23 episodes because the person above you is not at all episodes produced. I was like, okay, technically you're right. That leaves a little bit of a censor crappy taste in my mouth, just a little. Okay, so maybe, okay, so that was Stephen Amell talking and not Michael Rosenbaum, so excuse me for that. Admittedly, it was a trying time for Amell, where actors and we're sensitive and we take everything personally. And so it is difficult, the actor said, it is also difficult to argue with Warner Brothers Television because they are prolific and they have been in business forever. That's true. In the back of his mind, he thought, the entity of Arrow is bigger than me. I'm replaceable. But no, you're not. No, you're not, Steven. You are an amazing Green Arrow. You're amazing. Yeah, I would actually read that comic book now because of that TV series and because of your portrayal of him. So when I did my renegotiation, it wasn't fun because I have a lot of friends who have been in similar positions, and I knew what the actual numbers were. I'm very good friends with Jared Padalecki, and he shared information with me that Tom Welling shared with him. All right, good. Cool. It is everyone trying to help each other out, right? And I have gone on to share that information with people that I think it might be beneficial to. The actor said, I'm trying to be a broker, a salary increase. I'm trying to broker a salary increase. But when you're hearing a final offer, I heard final offer. I went, that's cool. I'm good with my current deal. And then there was dead silence for weeks and weeks and weeks. More on this story after this break.
Golden State Media Concepts bring you Book Review Podcast, a haven for bookworms of all ages and the widest genres, from mystery to memoirs, romance to comedy, fantasy to sci-fi. If you love to read, this is the podcast for you. It's the Golden State Media Concepts Book Review Podcast.
Welcome back. Once again, you're listening to Golden State Media Concepts Entertainment Podcast. This is your Captain Keith talking about Stephen Amell from Arrow and his situation with his rate of pay as the star of the hit TV series. The timing was bad as the renegotiations were going on right before the CW's big crossover event with Arrow and The Flash and Legends of Tomorrow and Supergirl. Was set to begin filming. Amell described that shoot as difficult since they treated it like a normal run of production. Despite being in different stages of development, there was just no wiggle room. It wasn't until this year that they started building in down days to the production. He said, certain productions would go dark for a couple of days so you could actually move the actors around. Very cool picture of him in the Green Arrow outfit. Working on multiple shows without having finalized his contract was stressful. The very first time I did it was going and doing the pilot of The Flash. It was one scene. It doesn't matter if you're getting one scene. You're getting one scene of an established character that I'm used to getting X number of dollars to portray in an episode of television. So there was a little bit of animosity, he admitted. But when it actually came for a proper renegotiation, I decided that I thought it would be advantageous for me to take a slightly lower amount on crossovers because ultimately my financial incentive on the show revolves around my episodic fee. Now that crossovers are bigger events, it's become very hard for Amell as he has had to read four scripts, work with four directors and tell one cohesive story, he explained. I always take some time with directors to just go, okay, where are we? Which show? That's going to be hour three. Yep. Okay. What just happened? Just make sure that I know where I am. Right. By nature, Amell isn't a complainer. I love going to other sets. He said, however, he would change the call sheet order to match the context of the episode. If I have the most to do in the crossover, and I did this year, treat me like number one, as in prioritize my time and get me out of there so that I can either go to another production or be rested for the following day, he said. Each show prioritizes their own actors, and that's fine. I get it. I just would do it differently. New episodes of Arrow will begin airing Monday, October 15th at 8 p.m. Man, I gotta wait until October? After that, the series' future is uncertain. My contract is up after 7. I think there's going to be some clarity on my future in the show soon, the actor teased. It was very interesting feeling once we were picked up for season 7 because all of a sudden I saw the finish line. Even if it's many, many years from now, that would be up to me and not up to the studio, who has had me under contract willingly. I signed it. I have no regrets that I signed it, but every year it's like, we're going to pick up another season. You have to come back. Season 8 would not be that. We're talking about it. Season 8 would not be that. We're talking about it. Okay. That doesn't necessarily mean he's looking to leave the show. The passion is still there 100%, and we have a lot of new blood on the show, which I think is important. This is what I've been thinking about. What else does my character have to do? He said, it's possible the showrunners could kill off his character. He doesn't have superpowers, but Amell finds it incredibly hard to believe that would ever happen. Furthermore, he argued, I don't know that anyone would allow themselves to be cornered by killing the title character of the show. Exactly, because there is no show at that point. That's what we call jumping the shark. Don't want to do that. The only thing that is left for him to do, and he doesn't have to die to do this, is he needs to leave a legacy. Because we have all these other shows that exist. So whether Arrow continues on in the absence of Oliver Queen or someone else took up the mantle of the Green Arrow, I think leaving a legacy is the one box that is left to tick for the character, Amell said. Although he's loved working on the series, he admitted, I wouldn't take Arrow right now because my life has changed. I'm in LA. My life is different. I understand why I'm still doing it. But if it ended and somebody came to me and said, all right, we have a lead role for you on a television show, I would go, before you tell me anything, where does it shoot? If they say Vancouver, I'd go, okay, but when and how many episodes? And if the number was north of 10, I would say no. Arrow put Amell on the map, but working year round has also been limiting. I don't really have the ability right now to be aspirational elsewhere because of how many episodes it is. And so I worry sometimes about being the guy that people will think has only ever done Arrow. I worry that if I stay on the show through 10 seasons, and I respect people who do that. I have great admiration for Tom staying for 10 years, for Jensen Ackles and Jared Padalecki going into their year 14 or 15 or whatever it is for Supernatural, another amazing show. I also have respect for you going, you know what, I did 7, I'm good, and it's time to move on, he told Rosenbaum. I worry that if I stick around until I'm 40, is there a chance I've sacrificed the next 25 years of my career because I maybe stayed a little too long? But at the same time, Amell took a moment to recognize the extraordinary fans who have watched his show in their homes every week for season years. People are so kind and so thoughtful. And I'm just so lucky to be involved in something that has been so captivating for so many people. The stuff that they've shared with me, it's life-changing, man. He said it's also why he is eternally grateful. The opportunity I could go on to do things that people think are way more significant or bigger profile, or the movies or whatever the case may be. Arrow will always be the most important thing that's ever happened to me professionally, he said, ever. That was a very nice thing to say. So, Keeping up with Kanye. It's back. Kanye West argues wearing small sandals is the Japanese way. Okay, so yeah, you're going to get a double dose of Kanye. After his footwear made headlines at 2 Chainz' wedding, Kanye West took to Twitter to explain his shoe style. The gold digger rapper and his wife, Kim Kardashian, attended the Miami nuptials between 2 Chainz and Keisha Ward earlier this month. The Keeping Up with the Kardashian star wore a neon green dress, a shade she'd been rocking all week, while her husband donned a mint green suit. However, it was his footwear that raised a few eyebrows. Not only did Yeezy head rock a sock and sandal combination, but he also wore shoes that appeared to be a few sizes too small. But on Tuesday, West explained he had actually been wearing his sandals the Japanese way. He also tweeted pictures of what appeared to be a version of the traditional Japanese shoe, the Gita. The straps should be snug but not too tight between the toes. Part of the illustration read, it's also stated your heel should extend 1 to 2 centimeters off the back of the wooden sole. So what does Kardashian think of his shoe style? While the reality star didn't comment on the look, she did rock a similar sock and sandal combination in July. There you go. And I'm looking at it. So yeah, and all I have to say is, yeah, I'm just not wearing sandals that are too small for my feet. I'm not doing that. But hey, you know, You're Kanye West. I guess you can pull it off. So, all right. So I know my limits when it comes to fashion. Some things I'll never wear. You won't see me in spandex. It's just not going to happen. It would just be inappropriate for me to do. So, but you know, there's other things I look better in. So I'm okay with that. You know, one size does not fit all. That's a lie. Kanye West talks Drake. The story of Adonai and slavery was a choice. New article, new interview today, actually. Kanye West is in fine form doing an emotional interview. And you can actually watch this video interview too. Kanye West is currently sitting down for a conversation on Chicago's 107.5 WGCI, in which a wide variety of topics were and are discussed at length. When asked about Pusha T's The Story of Adonai and Drake, Yeezy opened up about the fallout. It hits me in a really sensitive place, he explains, because you like hang around people and they come to your house and be around your family and this and that. And then they get mad about a beat and then send you purple demon emojis. He also felt Drake was being insensitive to his situation, given the proximity to the infamous TMZ incident. I feel that it was insensitive for Drake to, in any way, stress me out in any way after TMZ. While I'm in Wyoming healing, pulling all the pieces together, working on my music, and you know, we'll reconcile that one day because we got work to do. And these voices is just too powerful. But, okay, before I go on with the article, so I understand where Kanye West is coming from. Like he feels like Drake was being insensitive, but do you understand where Drake was coming from? Your artist, Pusha T, made a diss record that said way too much, that went way too personal, that other MCs and hip-hop legends like Ice Cube also stated that, you know, you go a little too far. You don't talk about people's parents and, you know, you just... You know, even though for a lot of people out in this world today, they think there aren't rules in hip hop, but there are rules in hip hop. People just forgot that. So I get that Kanye feels like Drake was being insensitive, but, you know, I think you were being insensitive to Drake, you know, because Pusha T is your artist and you knew what that song was going to do and you let it go out. So, you know, you have to claim some responsibility in that regard. That's a two-way thing. So, and one might say that you're being insensitive and that you might have a lot of nerve and audacity to say that you think that he was insensitive to you because of what you went through on TMZ, of actually what you put yourself through on TMZ. So, you know, and I'm a Kanye fan and I'm a Drake fan. I like both, you know, I like their music. But yeah, I think you're being very subjective in what you said in that regard. But let's finish this article. But I want to say that to you. He also appeared to address Jimmy Kimmel's "Does Donald Trump care about black people?" comments, providing what seems to be a thoughtful answer. I feel that Trump cares about the way black people feel about him, and he would like for black people to like him like they did when he was cool in the rap songs and all this. That's an accurate statement. Yeah, I do believe that. Yes. He would do the things that are necessary to make that happen because he's got an ego like all the rest of us. Yes, I agree. And he wants to be the greatest president, and he knows that he can't be the greatest president without the acceptance of the black community. So it's something he's going to work towards, but we're going to have to speak to him. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Kanye West is on point with that. Clarifying his infamous slavery comment, Kanye attempts to add some context, claiming that it sounded like a choice specifically to the spirit of Kanye West, which I think is aligned with the spirit of Harriet Tubman, which I think is aligned with the spirit of Nat Turner. He proceeds to speak on how speaking in English is a form of slavery, as it's not even his native tongue of Swahili. Okay. I am not crazy, but I can definitely go there if pushed, he admits, explaining he has ways of controlling it. I have the luxury version of mental health. Still, that doesn't stop him from adding his own insight, claiming we all have undiagnosed mental health issues. He says, the biggest stigma of being called crazy is you instantly get written off, that you don't know what you're talking about. That's true. It's one of the stigmas. I agree. I want to take this moment right now to say I'm sorry for the 1-2 effect of the MAGA hat into the slave comment, says Yeezy. I'm sorry to people who felt let down by that moment. Yeezy's apology literally brings one of the hosts to tears, and she says, your voice is so powerful. You have the ability to make changes for the African-American community. Kanye responds by asking, can I have a hug? So very cool. And I have, I mean, there's just, yeah, it's like a Kanye Palooza, but, you know, the show's almost over, and I promised you one more story on the Queen of Soul. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, Aretha Franklin's four-day memorial service includes multiple outfit changes. So, yes, her funeral's this week, her service is this week, and, yes, the Queen of Soul will be changing her outfits and in her casket. She has a wardrobe change, and let me read it, and I'll tell you what I think about it. The Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, will be laid to rest in style. The funeral home in charge of the homegoing service for the late Aretha Franklin has announced that she will have multiple outfits in true diva fashion. Executive Vice President of Swanson Funeral Home, Linda Swanson, said the Franklin family authorized her to reveal that the music icon's wardrobe will be changed days leading up to her burial on Friday in Detroit's Woodlawn Cemetery. Swanson did not disclose details on the exact number of outfit changes the Queen of Soul will have, but she hinted that it will be a surprise and it will be natural changes in wardrobe that a queen would make, according to the Detroit Free Press. The music icon's body arrived in a custom 4,024 karat gold plated casket at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit on this past Tuesday, yesterday morning, for the start of her 2-day public viewing. Yep, but there it is. So look, she's the Queen of Soul. We just lost our queen. And you know what? If the Queen of Soul wants to have a wardrobe change for her funeral, you know, for her casket, I'm all for it. She can get away with it. She has that respect. And we definitely have love for the Queen of Soul. This is a lady who knew she was dying last year and still performed a free concert for the people of Detroit. You know, and she's been very generous in her dealings and her philanthropy. And she was a brilliant artist, was and is a brilliant artist. So nothing but love for Aretha. So I was talking to a friend of mine earlier, and I was like, well, when Celia Cruz died, they took her casket on tour, like a funeral tour. They took her around from different places. It was like a party. It was a tour. I had never heard of that before. And my friend, he has said that that's kind of normal, that he has heard of that before with other famous celebrities. But I'm like, if Celia Cruz, and may she rest in peace too, amazing singer, if they can take her body on tour for a celebration for her fans, then there's nothing wrong with Aretha Franklin having different, a change of dress to make sure she's always looking good, even in death. I'm okay with that, definitely. Well, good people of the planet Earth and the known universe, thank you for listening to Golden State Media Concepts Entertainment Podcast. This has been your Captain Keith. I had a good time. I hope you did. I appreciate you all. Thanks for listening. And until next time, I'll see you somewhere out in space.
You've been listening to the Golden State Media Concepts Entertainment Podcast, part of the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. You can find this show and others like it at www.gsmcpodcast.com. Download our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play. Just type in GSMC to find all the shows from the Golden State Media Concepts Podcast Network. From movies to music, from sports to entertainment, and even weird news. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. Thank you, and we hope you have enjoyed today's program.